we could do a thing at the end of a retreat, suggestion box, and was this a good retreat and all that. The worldly way of looking at this retreat would be like, what was the quality of the food? Right? How was the swimming pool? So then you have a kind of the idea of meditation being Club Med. This is North America. So, you know, like one kind of looks at that. But obviously I think what's important in a retreat is was I able to be mindful? And that seems to me what's important. I was teaching retreats every summer in Latvia until I came here to be with Mom. And this was some years ago. That was the last century. And one of the first retreats we did, we rented a school in the country. And this was only like 5 years after post-Soviet times. So it was very, you know, culturally fascinating. And these people were in the back of the yawn. And to see a character like me. And then when I spoke Latvian, that really blew them away. No, I figured this out. So we're doing this retreat. And there was the retreat, there was the school which we were renting. It had 4 showers. One worked. We had 30 people. And there was the meditation hall, which is a schoolroom, and there was the women's dormitory, which is a schoolroom, and there was the men's dormitory, which is a schoolroom. I got the principal's office. But it was quite nice because it was so rustic. You know, you had to get everyone had to chip together. It was physically difficult. These people are really tough Latvians because they've been through so much. There's something quite nice about that, the communality of it. Anyway, it's summertime, so the walking meditation is outside. And there was this one elderly lady, she lived near the school, and we were doing, much of the walking meditation was around the school grounds. And she would just kind of hang out in her window watching us. She was just, what are they doing? Back and forth, back and forth. And on the last day or second dance day, she couldn't handle anyone. And she just yelled out, why don't you get a ball and just do something? This is an esoteric practice. So we come to the end of the retreat. So thank you, Adrian. And Andre. You know, when the retreat goes this well, you know there's been a lot of work in the background. It does take a lot of work to organize these, so thank you so much. Thank you to the Buddha, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho, the whole lineage of teachers. To deepen the practice, what I've been actually talking with various people about trying to create more situations for lay people which are helpful to deepen the practice. So I was talking with Gilles, he's a good friend from the University of Ottawa, and he was part of the Zen group at Sandy Hill. And he showed me their website, and they have ways of commitment where a friend of the center can kind of sign up to do a self-retreat. They can make a commitment to do a certain daily practice. They can make a commitment to do like a 3-hour practice on a weekend or a 6-hour practice. And the center actually lays out what those 3 hours would be, or what those 6 hours would be, or what that daily life practice would be. And the person then takes that on board and goes to the teacher and makes a commitment to do that particular practice. That sounded like a very good idea. So we're going to try that, figure out maybe two or three ways that people could make that commitment. So be a commitment to yourself, but there is something about coming to a teacher and saying, I'm really going to try to do this, and if it's laid out, it can really be quite energizing. So we're going to try to do that. Another thing that Venerable Kinrock and I have been talking about, like we really noticed that, say, someone like from a Sri Lankan or a Thai background, they live in a Buddhist narrative. They've got the life stories, they know the disciples, they kind of live in a different world from us. But from as a Westerner, say, a Westerner comes at it from psychology, from philosophy, from, ethics and things like that. And sometimes I do think there's a kind of piece missing with Western Buddhists. It's that whole sense of what is this tradition, partially just what is Pali Buddhism as opposed to what is Mahayana, what is psychotherapy, what is Feldenkrais, what is Qigong, where does it all fit? Not to be dogmatic that this is the only way, but to actually know what is Theravada Buddhism. And one of the things that's very difficult is reading the suttas. That seems to be something that may be quite difficult. Venerable Kinrathana has a good sense of the suttas. I'm all right, but I've taken a lot of my teaching orally from. I've had very good teachers. I've been very, very lucky, and I hear teaching well orally. But what Venerable Kinrathana and I've been talking about, I'd like to do eventually get it down. Do a kind of 8-week course. Maybe, or six or whatever, on an introduction to the suttas, how to actually read them, how to read them, where they are, how you find them, where people get lost in the suttas, what do you do with the repetitions, just really, really kind of basic stuff so that people who have that kind of, who like that, who enjoy that, will feel confident to look into the suttas and get a feeling for what the sutta tradition is, what the Pali tradition is. And he's very good. Venerable Kinrathana's got a good, he's got a real good list mind. He's really good at setting up. So he already, I just mentioned it to him. 3 hours later, he had a course outline. So he's obviously been waiting for this. We're going to experiment with us first, and then if we get it down, then I'd like to maybe do it in town, and he thought he could do it at the monastery. So, like he was saying, like in meditation, you have your meditation technology, you have your cushion, your technique, how to sit, you're for an hour, you have a kind of a meditation piece that you've been implementing in your life. But this is what we sometimes lack is a study piece. Where you have this, like you collect your mind around a sutta and you use the sutta to reflect on. And that's quite meditative. Some of you might have heard Karen Armstrong's or read Karen Armstrong. That's her way. And when she talks about her experience as a Carmelite nun, she said she couldn't meditate. Couldn't pray. But when she goes into the scriptorium and she gets into the mindset of the mystic that's written this, that John of the Cross, whoever, she comes to their realization. So that's a scholar's way of coming to insight, which is also very important. It's a very valid way. You can see with her, she's quite a lovely spiritual mind. Lovely to listen to her. So we hope to do something like that too. So stay tuned. But it is interesting trying to introduce a tradition into an atmosphere which has so much Dharma from so many different good sides, very, very good sides, where it's not dogmatic, but it is defined. It is defined in some way. In Thailand, you take it all for granted, or Sri Lanka. We were thinking of like a Sunday school for adults, Like some, you know, like I was thinking of doing, you have to do all this. But like just the people of the Buddha. You know, who are the characters that inhabit the planet of the Buddha's time? The nuns, the monks, the important lay people. That would be, there's something quite rich that. Then you're really in the tradition. You feel it in a heartfelt way. So hopefully we can get some of that rolling. Now in terms of like termination, the way we usually make determinations in Pali Buddhism is we use the five precepts, the three refuges, and we're going to do that today. Well, this is voluntary, so you don't have to do the five precepts. I suggest you keep them, but you don't have to do it formally. But Nisanga asked if we could do that, so we'll do it formally. So whoever wants to do the five precepts, but this is a way that a person, like sometimes they ask, so how do you become a Buddhist? And I always, well, precepts and refuges, right? So this is a way you kind of make a statement to yourself, this is a particular path that I'd like to travel on. It doesn't exclude other paths. It's not that. It's a way of making a kind of clear statement about what the direction of my spiritual life. And that helps a lot with the ambiguity we have around spiritual life. Because there's so many concepts now. Like I was just saying, the idea that, you know, you have to burn out your karma, burn out some of your karma. That's not a terrible idea. It's not true. So if you had to burn out all your karma, you'd be burning for a long time. You'd never get it through. You'd never get through. It's just a pretty terrible. So it's just like, what's the difference between a lot of these New Age ideas that are kind of quasi true but not quite true, and what is Pali Buddhism? And that takes some study. And I think I've been negligent in that, not to any, but probably because of my inclination. I'm not a scholar. I don't approach it that way. So anyway, with the refuges and precepts, there's a part of the undertaking of a layperson who wants to deepen their commitment to this tradition, and true of any tradition, like whether it's the Tibetan tradition, these are kind of common ceremonies. One actually undertakes to learn the precepts in Nepali. It's not much Pali, it's very easy. Pali's very easy to memorize. And then make the determination to live by these things. Also, like it's quite good to memorize like that more opening chanting. If you want to kind of set up a practice, it's really nice if you have a small devotional piece to begin with, like the bowing. You know, you have a place, you have a shrine. A place is very helpful. That always reminds you of silence and stillness, rather than just kind of throwing a cushion down in the middle, you know, beside a toaster somewhere. I mean, if it's necessary, go for it. But obviously, if you have a corner and a place, it's very, very helpful. Something that's beautiful, it reminds you of silence, a Buddha image. That can be helpful, flowers. The traditional symbology of our shrines is we usually have a Buddha image, and a Buddha represents both the teacher and our own possibility. Personally, I don't like heads. I don't like beheaded Buddhas. Because it's iconographically incorrect. You know, it's as an icon, people shouldn't cut Buddha's heads off. It's not nice. Because the icon is the full thing. You know, it's the full image. It's the human image. Right? So what you have to look at, the difference between aesthetics, art, and iconography. Now, iconography, you can have an ugly-looking Buddha, but it can be very inspiring. You know, it can have a crooked nose, and the sculptor might not be great, but if you're looking at it as iconography, you say, the Buddha. If you're looking at it aesthetically, you think, I don't know. I don't like the flame on that one's head, or this one looks too big. So you choose from aesthetics, which is natural. But realize the difference between iconography and aesthetics. The nice thing is to have a beautiful icon. That's a nice combo. But as an icon, you need to, you know, it's the full Buddha. It's the posture. This is incorrect, this icon in the middle. The big one. Why is it incorrect? Because the eyes are closed. You notice in all the classical iconography, the eyes are open. Let's see the eyes closed. It'd be slightly open. It'd be closed. This is a Polish guy. This is Bija. He's great. He did that this morning. And so you get to learn the iconography, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. But you kind of appreciate like a Buddha image or a stupa, a jeti. And these remind you of enlightenment. If you go to Burma, this poor country, I mean, it's pathetic, Burma. But everywhere there are stupas. It kind of reminds us. I wish they'd remember. Junta. So on a traditional shrine, you have, the chick one here is, which one is different in all these? Well, all the Buddhas are different.
Mm-hmm. The one
with his eyes open, right?
Yeah.
That was Bijak's little joke. So you have the Buddha image. That's the icon which reminds you. So if you don't like Buddhist imagery, what other icon reminds you, or what image might remind you of enlightenment? It's a flower, means nothing. Empty space. You know, the Zen thing, or whatever. Then the candles, incense, flowers. The flowers represent sila, which is moral purity. And that the symbology there is that when we live a good life, then it's like a flower. It's beautiful. Our life is beautiful. Also, the withering of the flowers represents anicca. You have that too. The incense represents the meditative mind, the sweetness, the fragrance of incense, or just that one pointedness of the light. And then the candles represent wisdom, light which dispels darkness. So there's a whole symbology around the shrine. Sila, samadhi, panya, that's a triad that you hear a lot about. Morality, concentration, wisdom. So there's a, once you kind of plug into these things, you plug into a whole tradition. So the taking of the refuges and precepts is something that you can do on your own. If you find it helpful to have a shrine and learn to bow correctly. And then you chant. You also bhagava arahaṁ sammā sambuddho. You learn that. You memorize that. That's a part of your practice. Now you think about it, it's very calming. Right? You note in your mind. And what it does over time, it becomes a quick entry into that state of mindfulness because you've done it so often. Just like your meditation path. No, I am back. You know, there's something about our minds being reminded of purity, of goodness, through the architecture that we use and through the symbology that we use. So this can be helpful. Not necessary, but it can be helpful. So then as you do, like if you chant homage to the Buddha, trying to bring up that sense of human perfection, of human beauty, of enlightenment, of compassion, to bring that forward, because it's very helpful in a cynical time. So, you know, it's such an Armageddon time now, isn't it? Like end of days, you know, the planet is melting and the atmosphere is going and animals are dying, there's going to be no more fish in the sea, we'll be flooded out next year, you know, they're very, very heavy things. You know, if you take that on board, it can be very, very depressing. And there's serious things which need to be considered. But there's also this lovely part of human consciousness, and that's that aspiration and possibility. So bringing forth devotion, hopefulness, these are good things to do. They're very skillful. So that's the kind of way of entering into the meditation. Then if you chant the refuges, you keep remembering, what is Buddha? It's awake, being Buddha. Knowing Dharma, this is the way Ajahn Sumedho would talk, being Buddha. I am the Buddha. Not that. It's not ego. It's just a link. Nine Dharma. This is the way it is now. Ajahn Sumedho uses a line, this is the truth of the way things are. And then I think only you ask me, who's truth? Well, it's not dogmatic truth. It's not intellectual truth. It's not a Buddhist proposition. It's suchness. It's like, there's no definition for it. Right? Truth is this way. Silence. So the way the Buddha talked about himself, he referred to himself as the Tathagata. Yoso Tathagato Ahamsamma Santoto, we chant. The Tathagata is, if he talked about himself, the Tathagata did this and did that. Tathagata is self-realized, so he referred to himself. And Tathagata is one who knows suchness. It's an interesting way of thinking about it. Just such realized. Strange language. Such gone. Such realized. And what is suchness? Well, it's no more words. Words stop. It's this. And this is always changing. And then there's awareness of this. It's very, very simple. So when you chant Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, those are some of the not just thoughts but aspirations and even images that are helpful to bring to consciousness. Dhammang Saranam Gacchami is the whole body of teaching, but it's also just the taste of this moment. And when I ask you, just listen. It's Dhamma. Just the way it is now. And it's changing. Truth of the way things are. Sangha, Sanghang Saranam Gacchami, I take refuge in the Sangha, then that is, again, it can be a community of practitioners, but it's the doing. The precepts, the meditation, the whole path of goodness that we undertake. That's the doing. So you Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, Dhammang Saranam Gacchami, Sanghang Saranam Gacchami, Duttiyampi, a second time. Duttiyampi, Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, Dhammang, Tatiyampi, third time. So you do that, right? And you do it slowly, you do it carefully. It really helps your meditation. It's not, you don't kind of just, oh God, 45 and just squeeze it in before your next appointment. You plunk down and get a quick 40, So you kind of prepare your mind. It takes time. But the associations then, over time, are very skillful. You have an association of art, iconography, a liturgy, all of those things, which all religions use, bring you to a state of contemplative silence. Then the precepts, I take precepts to refrain from harming living beings, so not killing. And so that's a protection from impulses which are violent. My big problem is deer flies. I'm okay with humans. The deer flies, boy, they really get me. So, Panaki Bhattavaramani, how can I exclude deer flies from this? But it really is interesting how, like, when a fly, you can look at a fly as a nuisance, and it's gonna, its little feet are gonna crawl over your mango mousse or something like that. Or this is a creature that wants to live. It's a whole different honesty. And children sometimes, they can look at insects in a kind of delightful way and woo. So just not only is the first precept about letting go of violence, but it's also contemplating the opposite. Because the precepts always are conjoined with their opposite. It's not just restraint on impulses which are hurtful, but it's also cultivation of impulses which are compassionate. It's always, always both, because we have both. We have both. Sometimes they're not included. They're not included in the five precepts explicitly, but they're there. The second precept, I take the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. It's kind of a different way of talking about stealing. But that's a very important one. Maybe I'm working in a warehouse and everyone is, the moral standard is to basically what you can get away with. So you start, people start taking things out of the warehouse which don't belong to them. I'm to take a precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. I don't do it, even if everyone else is doing it. And that gives a lovely sense of self-respect. I'm to take a precept to refrain from infidelity, the third precept. That, I think, is a limited translation, because kamesu is actually, it means sensuality. So I undertake the precept to refrain from, I like to look at it more as sensual indulgence, right? Because one can be, you know, faithful in a relationship, but still be stoned on YouTube, right? Spend 5 hours, And that's where I think that precept gets also very interesting. Obviously, the precept of fidelity in relationships is very important. I mean, what can be more destructive? But also, just that, how much of our minds go into the sense world in a way which is unskillful, which make us kind of clogged up and restless or whatever. And that's the beauty of that. You can keep refining that precept. Keep refining it to your own life, your own lifetime, all the precepts you can. I take precept to refrain from incorrect speech. It's a lifetime, at least one lifetime's work, right? Speech which is truthful, speech which is honest, speech which is beautiful, as opposed to speech which is lying, speech which is hard, speech which is put down speech, all those ways of wrong speech. Humor. So can we joke? Are we allowed to make a joke?
Yeah.
But don't do it at the expense of someone else. Yeah. So if my humor is at the cost of your whatever, is that skillful? Everyone might laugh. Except the person who got hit. So humor. Or could humor be used for uplifting? I try to use humor, you know this, because this can get deadly serious. But humor has its point, you know, it's lovely, humor is lovely, but how do you use it? How do you use it skillfully? Speech, of course, include communication, emails, emails. Emails I get sent. Right? So there's so much around that you can work. And so as you take the precepts, either if you do it formally or just informally, you have a kind of mirror to reflect back how you're doing this. It helps to awaken you. It's not like these prohibitions, which thou shalt not, you go to hell, but they're rather helpful aids in being mindful. So it goes back to the same thing. How can I be more mindful? Sura Merya, I take precept to refrain from taking drugs and drink, which make me stoned and stupid. We all know that. You know, so can I drink a glass of sherry with Auntie at Thanksgiving? Don't know. That's your choice. Don't know. Can I do a little bit of infidelity? No. I don't think so. A little bit of killing. So they're kind of guidelines which give you a sense of commitment, I think. Help with a lot of the ambiguity of life, and are helpful for reflection. They all have their opposites. Compassion is the opposite of killing and aversion. Generosity is the opposite of stealing. Faithfulness, the opposite of infidelity. Beautiful speech as opposed to wrong speech. Sobriety as opposed to being drunk or whatever. And those are the beautiful aspects, and they are all aids for being mindful. Comes down to the same thing. We help you be mindful.